Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is coming to Washington. Memories linger about what his security detail did the last time he rolled through.
I was just thrown on the ground and repeatedly kicked in the head and in the back, and I was just couldn't imagine why would somebody hit me so violently.
Also, deadly Hong Kong protests leave some citizens skeptical of the democracy movement.
By shouting, "We want democracy," does not actually create democracy.
And thousands of people are writing letters to one of literature's greatest fictional characters.
The letters themselves were from all over, from Russia, Poland, California, all of them decorated stationery. One was 12 pages long.
But can the heroine of Romeo and Juliet give good life advice? I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to be with you. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case about DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Under DACA, young immigrants have been able to get work permits and protection from deportation. The Trump administration argues that the Obama-era program is unconstitutional and has moved to end it. But a group of DACA recipients filed a lawsuit to block that, a group that includes 29-year-old PhD candidate Norma Ramirez, who was brought to the U.S. from Mexico when she was five. We spoke just after the arguments wrapped up today, and she had left the Supreme Court building.
Walking out was pretty incredible. It was such a, like, the steps are high, you know, so when you're looking down and just showing to the whole country that we matter, that was very incredible.
Yeah, and what were you looking at as you came down the steps? Who was in front of you?
We have a lot of people who came out to support.
Palm is here! Palm is here!
Cheering. It's hard to anticipate what this day was going to feel like, you know. It's really incredible to see everyone here. There's a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. Just the fact that we are showing up and showing how strong and resilient we are.
Walk us through the hearing itself. What stands out for you from these oral arguments today?
It was just amazing to see certain justices up there, like Sonia Sotomayor, and the arguments themselves were very complex, I think, but we are hopeful. One thing that I think I can say is that the judges made it very clear that, or they recognize that DACA is supported by the general public, and that support is there, and so we should lean on that, I guess, in our communities, and not just in the legal system, but within our communities.
I mean, Norma, in the past we've had you on our show. You told us memorably that never in your wildest dreams you'd be suing the President of the United States. I was hearing earlier in that crowd cheers of undocumented, unafraid. So you seem pretty confident that the decision will be in your favor. If it's not, though, are you still unafraid? And then what happens?
Well, you know, fear is not a bad thing. We're scared. It's just part of our daily lives. But there is power in just showing up, showing our faces, showing who we are. DACA has protections, and, you know, clearly we want them. Clearly we're fighting for them. But as people, that doesn't change who we are inherently. The fact that we matter, the fact that just we're human beings. We have the full range of emotions, and regardless of what happens, we are still going to be here, and we will continue to be who we are.
Norma, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
This court case on DACA has raised many questions about the program's legality. To help sort this out is Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute in New York. Should the court have heard this case?
Well, I think almost everyone agreed today, which was, I think, quite interesting, is that the president has the authority to end the program. I think there was a lot of disagreement about whether he ended it lawfully and in an appropriate way. This is a large program affecting a large class of people, upending the lives of close to 800,000 DACA kids, and therefore it could not be done lightly.
So I noticed that one of the critiques that a lot of opponents of DACA have raised, and they say they have an issue with the program because it's unconstitutional, that it was set up by Barack Obama in 2012, allegedly with no input from the public. Is that a fair argument?
Well, that's exactly what led to the strange contradiction in the administration's position. Their first argument was, look, there's nothing to review. This is a policy, a decision by the administration. But then they proceeded to say that the reason we're ending it, because the program was illegal from the very beginning, because we disagreed with the legality of the program that the Obama administration put in place. That's a bit of a contradiction, because once it you say that this was because of a legal reason but not a policy reason that you're ending it, that makes it therefore reviewable.
Donald Trump tweeted that most people who are protected by DACA are not angels but very tough, hardened criminals. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a complete reversal of the president's position on the DACA kids. In fact, a related point was raised today in the Supreme Court by Justice Sotomayor, who said, well, you know, the DACA people had come to rely on president's statements about them because he had said very complimentary things about DACA kids in the past, that there is no way we're going to remove from the country a large number of kids who are so who are educated, who are contributing to the society. So this is a complete reversal of that sentiment. And it seems like this is a post facto justification to end the program, which is what makes the explanations of the administration sort of kind of contradictory.
What if the court sides with the White House? What would happen if more than 700,000 people suddenly lost their DACA status?
So they would become deportable and they would lose their work authorization. It's been the view of many of us that the DACA has been a classic case where all three branches of the government have played ping pong with each other, that they have hoped that the other branch would bail them out.
Yeah, and it strikes me Congress would really have to address a broken immigration system, which they've been trying to pass comprehensive immigration reform for years, at least since George W. Bush was in office. Do you see DACA as part of a piecemeal approach that is in fact justifiable in the medium term until immigration reform happens?
That's a really good question. The interesting thing is that if the court decides to terminate DACA, then Congress will have to deal with it. That decision will come smack in the middle of a very polarized election campaign. But Congress may have no choice but to deal with it because of the equities of the Dreamers. And therefore, the question is that will something like DACA provide this rare opportunity to end the logjam that has characterized the immigration debate for the last 20 years?
Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute in New York. Thank you for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Trump is laying out the welcome mat for Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's scheduled to visit the White House tomorrow. Not everyone thinks it's such a great idea. Members of Congress from both parties are still outraged by Erdogan's decision last month to send Turkish troops into northern Syria to attack Kurds. There's also a bitter memory of what happened the last time Erdogan came to the capital. His security guards beat up protesters about a mile from the White House. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
The incident happened in broad daylight. There are numerous videos of what happened, shot by protesters and reporters on the scene. The videos show a group of people gathered outside the Turkish ambassador's home in Washington. One person is holding a megaphone, another is waving a banner. President Erdogan's motorcade pulls up. Erdogan is riding in a black Mercedes. Several men in dark suits get out, and a few minutes later, there's a brawl.
We don't know who is hitting whom. Their number is 5-6 times more than our number, and we are not, we're just a civilian. We are not trained for the fight.
Murat Yasa was the protester holding the megaphone. Two men shove him to the ground and start kicking him repeatedly.
This is all I remember. The woman next to me, they tried to attack her. I bent over to the towards to the woman. Her name is Lucy. When I tried to cover her, someone pushed me. They were kicking me, my head. I mean, they were trying to kill me.
The woman Yasa was trying to help is Lucy Yusoyan. She took a beating as well.
I was just thrown on the ground and repeatedly kicked in the head and in the back, and I was just couldn't imagine why would somebody hit me so violently, because I was not posing any threat.
Yasuo doesn't remember what happened next. Later, he learned he had a broken nose, loose teeth, and plenty of bruises. Yusoyan says she passed out, was taken to the hospital, and suffered short-term memory loss. No one died, but at least 11 people went to the hospital on that day. I asked Yasuo why he was in Washington. What was he protesting? He says his grievances with the Turkish government go way back. Yasuo was born to a Kurdish family in Turkey. He says growing up as a persecuted minority meant all kinds of discrimination.
Kurdish language was prohibited even to speak in Kurdish in public on the street.
Yasuo fled Turkey and settled in the U.S. in 1987. 5 years later, he became a U.S. citizen. Here in the States, he felt free to speak out against the way the Turkish government treats the Kurds. And that's why he and other protesters were in Washington on that day, in 2017, when Turkey's president was visiting the White House.
We wanted to go protest him because we want to make sure that he hears our voice, that we are against his dictatorship.
What Yasuo didn't expect was to be attacked by Erdogan's security guards on American soil with American policemen standing nearby.
This is our right. This is the First Amendment, freedom of speech. There was no violence from us.
Criminal charges were brought against 15 members of Erdogan's security team. Two of them, Turkish-born U.S. citizens, pled guilty and spent a year in jail. Charges against some of the attackers were dropped. Andreas Akaras is a lawyer in Washington. He represents some of the injured protesters who filed a case against the Turkish government.
Interestingly enough, the last batch of charges that were dropped basically the day before. Then Secretary of State Tillerson left to go to Turkey to meet with high-ranking officials, including, I believe, President Erdogan.
The Turkish embassy in Washington didn't respond to my request for an interview. But Akara says the perpetrators need to face justice.
These individuals were on rightful public property, expressing the most basic American freedoms. And they were attacked by agents of a foreign government in the heart of the nation's capital. When you hear that, when you see that, you instinctively want to respond.
Akara says it wasn't the first time. Turkish security personnel attacked protesters in 2016 outside of a think tank in Washington. And in 2011, Erdogan's bodyguards assaulted security guards at the United Nations in New York, and the list goes on. This week, Erdogan's visit comes at a time when the U.S.-Turkish relationship is at an all-time low, says Henri Barkey of Lehigh University in Pennsylvania.
It has never been this bad, as far as I can remember. There are many, many different issues over which the United States and Turkey actually disagree.
But Trump calls Erdogan a friend. So I asked Barkey, what's going on here?
Look, I'm not a psychologist to be able to answer that question. But clearly, Trump has an affinity with strongmen, authoritarians, whether it is Orban in Hungary or Putin in Russia.
Recent moves by Erdogan have outraged both Republicans and Democrats in Washington. Turkey sent troops to northern Syria. It has purchased advanced weapons systems from Russia. And one of Turkey's biggest banks has helped Iran get around U.S. sanctions. This week, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House even asked Trump to rescind his invitation to Erdogan. So far, that hasn't happened. Protesters Yusoyan and Yasa say they are disappointed with Trump's decision to host Erdogan again. They plan to be in Washington tomorrow to protest. Only this time, Yasa says, he'll bring a hard hat with him, just in case. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Brush fires have been raging across Australia. Carol Sparks, the mayor of Glen Innes in New South Wales, described the scene there this way.
We had fireballs and we had trees on fire and walls of flame coming at us.
Fireballs and walls of flame. 4 people have died, 150 homes have been lost, and thousands more are at risk.
My home was severely damaged. My neighbour's home was totally destroyed. Many people had to run. My granddaughter's partner was severely burnt. and my neighbour was killed in the car trying to get away.
Officials had been bracing for today. That's because weather conditions were literally out of control, according to Anthony Bradstreet with the New South Wales Rural Fire Service.
We were seeing 80 kilometres per hour winds. We were seeing temperatures in the high 30s, humidity down around 5% in many areas. And under those conditions, you really can't fight these fires. Fires are uncontrollable.
80 kilometer per hour winds, that's about 50 miles per hour. People are dealing with the immediate damage of the fires, but some are also asking, what's causing this? It's prompted a debate about the role climate change may be playing.
What climate change has done is it has exacerbated the conditions under which bushfire happened. So we are now seeing increasing intensity and frequency of this natural hazard.
That's Imran Ahmad, a climate scientist at the Australian National University. He says climate change has made fires more intense and also extended the fire season. Some politicians in Australia, though, are saying it's not the time to be talking about why. Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormick had this to say in an interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
We've had fires in Australia since time began. And what people need now is a little bit of sympathy, understanding, and real assistance. They need help. They need shelter.
Why is it wrong to ask those questions?
Well, they don't need the ravings of some pure, enlightened, and woke capital city greenies at this time.
Fire victims don't need the ravings of some pure, enlightened, and woke capital greenies. Prime Minister Scott Morrison was a bit gentler when he was asked a question about climate change on Sunday. He refused to answer and said, "My only thoughts today are with those who have lost their lives and their families." This stance may put the federal government in Australia at odds with local officials who are seeing these fires up close. Here's Mark Greenhill, mayor of the city of Blue Mountains.
We're in the middle of an unprecedented national drought. We are experiencing weather conditions for the last 15 years that keep breaking records. It doesn't take a genius to work out that there are climactic issues at play, and as a nation, we need to have a policy response to that. Any government that isn't alive to the realities of climate change is not being responsible.
And here's another one of those local leaders, Carol Sparks, the Glen Innes mayor we heard from earlier, whose home was severely damaged.
I am upset, I've got to say. Climate change seems to be something that we're not allowed to mention over here because of apparently it's not happening in some quarters. However, look at the evidence. Come with me and I'll show you some evidence.
Fire officials warn that warm, windy conditions will continue and no significant rain is in sight. A bitter election just wrapped up in New Zealand. There were many candidates, loud candidates, some would say obnoxious, and each fought hard for the win. Now, as the World Sarah Birnbaum reports, New Zealand is trying to build bridges, even amid rumors of foul play.
Drum roll, please.
The country was tense as officials announced the results on New Zealand Public Radio.
And the winner is...
For the first time ever, a seabird is New Zealand's Bird of the Year. Ooh. So congratulations to the hoi hoa.
The Bird of the Year contest is no joke. The candidates, or birds, have passionate supporters. The campaigns rent billboard space, and there's a fair amount of negative advertising. This ad was put out by the committee to elect the Karamako, and it portrays a rival, the Kakapo, as a crazed dictator.
My fellow moss chickens, the time has come. We're all set for world domination.
That was a dramatization, by the way. But ugly tactics didn't win the day. Voters chose the yellow-eyed penguin, the hoi ho, as the bird of the year. It is one of the rarest penguins in the world, and it's true, it is a beautiful bird, but it also sounds like this. The hoi ho edged out the kakapo, you know, the one bent on world domination, and maybe it was because of the impressive celebrity endorsements, like this one from Dunedin Mayor Aaron Hawkins.
It's with a heavy heart that I can no longer bring myself to support Kereru for Bird of the Year. Not when the mainland population of our own precious megachonk, the hoi ho, is in such a parlous state.
Post-election, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern even reached across the avian aisle to congratulate the winner, though she didn't leave partisanship completely aside.
I feel inclined to congratulate the winner, given it's the first seabird.
to have taken out top honours. And many of you will know my long-standing commitment and support for the black petrel. So I'm hoping that this is paving the way for a future win for a black petrel.
What Audern didn't mention were the accusations of election meddling. On Twitter, some voters complained of Russian interference. There are votes cast from all over the world, including some 300 votes from Russia. Though Megan Hubscher with the conservation group Forest and Bird that runs the election says there are safeguards in place.
We do have an awesome volunteer team who scrutinize our election results. So they go through all the data and make sure it looks the way it should look. We're not getting too many votes from one IP address and all the rest of it. And they've gone through all our data this year and given it the thumbs up.
And Hubscher says with all the campaigning and the trash talk, it's important not to lose sight of why they hold this poll in the first place, and that's to raise awareness.
3/4 of New Zealand's birds are heading for extinction, and we really need to change up the ways that we do things, not just in New Zealand, but around the world as well.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We have some of the fiercest memes from the Hoiho social media account. It's on our Instagram. We are at PRI The World. Tomorrow, two big international news stories converge in Washington, and both start with President Trump making a phone call. The first was the now infamous call from Trump to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That sparked the impeachment inquiry.
That call was perfect. It couldn't have been nicer, and even the Ukrainian government put out a statement.
The public phase of the impeachment inquiry begins tomorrow with Bill Taylor's testimony, Taylor being the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine. Then there is the other big presidential phone call, the one Trump made to Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That call upended alliances in the war in Syria.
Let someone else fight over this long, bloodstained sand.
President Erdogan and Trump will meet at the White House tomorrow, as we reported earlier. And not far away on Capitol Hill, Ambassador Taylor will be testifying. We'll be on both stories tomorrow. You're with The World. India is charting a path toward green energy, but Indian coal is fighting back with tourism in coal mines.
And you go down what's like a ski lift, but it's going down instead of up, and it takes you into the mine about 6,000 feet. There's a ventilator, it's blowing air, it's very loud.
Coal sightseeing coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Former president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, arrived in Mexico today. He resigned from the presidency on Sunday after weeks of protests over disputed election results. Morales has said he fled his country because his life was in danger. Mexico is now offering him political asylum. The World's Maria Elena Romero has been following the story. Maria Elena, Evo Morales was president of Bolivia for 14 years. How did he stay in power that long?
Evo Morales did two things right. One was to transform the economy of Bolivia, and the second one was to transform the political process in the country. He rode the economic boom of commodity prices. Bolivia sustained economic growth during his presidency. He also reduced poverty rates. In 2007, the poverty rate in Bolivia was 60%, and by 2017, it just reached 36%.
You also mentioned political change under Evo Morales. What happened in that realm?
One of his big accomplishments was to integrate indigenous people into the political process. Previous to Morales becoming president, indigenous group in Bolivia, which comprised 40% of the population, struggle for rights. The political class was dominated by wealthy families of European descent. And in 2009, Morales put forward a new constitution that not only made Bolivia a secular country and not a Catholic country like before, and also established Bolivia as a plurinational state, meaning that all the indigenous communities inside will have political power.
That seems pretty significant.
Yes, it is, because that was his political base that he was benefiting. But I spoke to the director of the Center for Documentation and Information in Bolivia. His name is Oscar Campanini. He told me that, yes, Evo Morales transformed the political scene in Bolivia, but that didn't last for long.
Desde ese momento, Bolivia significó para gran parte del mundo un proceso interesante.
When Evo Morales first came to power, his presidency became a symbol of transformation and social rebellion. But during the 14 years of Evo Morales' government, that idea has changed. Increasing social discontent during the years of his presidency have brought us to this moment of great social conflict in Bolivia.
So it sounds like Morales did a lot for indigenous communities, but it's a mixed record. And his tenure was not without controversy either, right?
That's right. Morales made decisions that benefited indigenous communities, but he also implemented projects that infuriated them. The turning point was in 2010, when there was a proposal to build a road through an indigenous territory in the Bolivian Amazon. And indigenous people actually came together and marched towards La Paz, and they faced police repression. And this was something unthinkable for the first indigenous president of Bolivia and someone who actually led the transformation of indigenous rights in the country.
Right. I mean, the indigenous community finally had an indigenous president, and yet here are these police clashing with these indigenous leaders.
Exactly. I spoke to indigenous activist Ruth Alipascuki. She participated in the protest back in 2010, and she says that after that incident, Evo Morales lost the full support from his political base.
Ocurrió que el 25 de septiembre de 2010, pues había una violenta represión a los pueblos indígenas y encontramos que eso era solamente el principio.
After the violent repression of indigenous groups, we found out that this was just the beginning. After that, what Evo Morales did was to violate the rights of the indigenous population of Bolivia. He also divided and weakened the organizations that represent us.
So Morales' support among indigenous communities started crumbling back then. Today, Maria Elena, what is the Bolivia that Evo Morales has left behind?
Well, Morales leaves not only a political vacuum in the country, but also a very divided Bolivia. He does still have some indigenous support in La Paz. There have been marches echoing Morales' words, saying that this was a coup. But many indigenous leaders are accepting that he's gone, and they just have to look to the future. I spoke with Lino Ilimuriapano. He's a leader with the Uchupiamona indigenous community north of La Paz, and this is what he told me.
We are analyzing the current situation, and what we want now is the unity of indigenous people in Bolivia. We want to maintain a single vision of the type of development that we want, and we will be calling for a meeting in December to vote for new leaders who can assume the challenge of bringing us together and fighting for our rights with a single voice.
Meanwhile, Maria Elena, Bolivia's without a leader, and we don't really know what comes next. The World's Maria Elena Romero, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Hong Kong is on the brink of total collapse. That's a quote from police there. And still, about 1,000 pro-democracy protesters today rallied in central Hong Kong during the lunch hour, blocking roads. Yesterday, police shot a protester at close range. A pro-Beijing supporter was doused with flammable liquid and set on fire. Christine Lowe says the scenes of mayhem are frightening local residents. Lowe was a top official in Hong Kong's previous government, where she advocated for democratic reforms, but she's now critical of the protesters' tactics.
People are angry and frustrated, and, you know, we all feel this kind of heartbreak, you know. It's like you're holding your stomach most of the time, not quite sure what's happening to your city.
Do you support the protest movement?
I support that we need all kinds of reform in Hong Kong. It's very hard for me to say that I really support the violent forms of the protest. So I separate the two. I think Hong Kong's future lies with China, and there is a structure for a different second system that operates within the larger country of China. And that's an extraordinary privilege. There's nowhere else where there is such a privilege and an experiment, and I want that to work.
You no doubt saw the video that's been circulating today of the pregnant woman getting pepper sprayed and wrestled to the ground by a group of men wearing riot gear, helmets. I mean, this woman looks like she's dressed to go to work at a bank or something. How did you react to that video?
I think that's not a good thing to have happened. One of the major issues in Hong Kong is that the police have absorbed a lot of the frustration. And it's a very difficult situation because, of course, the police is there for law and order. And it's not just about piling on more criticism for the police. We need to get back to a point where we rebuild enough trust to have processes that allow our society to talk to each other.
So how do you do that? Because it doesn't look like people are pulling back and talking to each other. In fact, the protest movement has only grown more aggressive.
This is something very new for Hong Kong people. We've never had a situation where the community is so divided that we're having arguments with our family members. Parents and children are arguing. Husband and wives have argued. Friends and siblings have fought, and it's hurt their relations. As individuals, as colleagues, as friends, we have to also retune ourselves to be able to talk to each other again.
So as you say, the whole issue has really divided people, divided families. But why do you think there has not been a widespread rejection of the protesters?
I think nobody condones the kind of violence that we're seeing. I mean, you know, we're having people go and bash up our subway system. We have businesses that are being trashed. And it is disturbing to see for ordinary people like myself and others.
Those businesses that have been attacked, have they come out against the protesters?
There's fear in Hong Kong that your personal information is going to be doxxed. I think, you know, the news media around the world have reported on this. Businesses are concerned that if they said anything to condemn the violence, that their business are going to be thrashed. You know, so this is a very unhappy situation for many people. I don't think they're silent because their shop front has been bashed up means that they condone the violence.
Help us understand what settling with Beijing would actually look like. I mean, what compromise can you imagine?
We do have to reassure them politically that we're not going to split off from China. Once I think that's clearly settled, it is possible to argue about many things. I mean, if we look at another part of China, let's talk about Shanghai.
But what you've just described, let me just jump in here. I mean, what you're saying is a compromise for you is a return to the status quo that won't be accepted by the protesters. So I don't see how this all plays out.
I don't agree with you. What the protesters say they want is universal suffrage. They want more democracy. More democracy has to be negotiated over time. I think just saying that we want democracy will not create democracy itself. What creates democracy is to be able to define the processes, the electoral reforms and so on that will take place over a period of time. Just by shouting we want democracy does not actually create democracy.
What is your message, Christine Lo, to the protesters' rank and file?
I think we need to step back from the brink of more violence because only then will we be able to actually embark on the very difficult and long journey to negotiate, renegotiate, reimagine this one country, two system structure that has been given to us. So the earlier we can get back to that, the earlier we will have a chance to actually get the sort of things that the younger people want in Hong Kong. They want a more democratic system. They want their freedoms to be guaranteed. But you can't use violence, continuing violence, to say, that's the freedom that I want.
Christine Lo in Hong Kong, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Christine Lo teaches at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. She's the author of the book, The Chinese Communist Party in Hong Kong. Fictional characters 2 days in a row? It's getting to be a habit. Yesterday on The World, you heard about mail time on the old kid show Blue's Clues.
We just got a letter. We just got a letter.
Today, a story about letters to a different fictional character, one of the most famous in literary history. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
For centuries, people have visited Verona, Italy, to see the fictional home of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
You can stand on Juliet's balcony, write her a letter, and surprisingly get a reply from a club with a recognizable name.
The Juliet Club.
The Juliet Club. Giovanna Tamasia is the manager. Her father founded the club in 1972. Now more than 20,000 men and women write to Juliet every year.
If you think who writes to Juliet, who takes the pen and writes to someone they don't know, it can sound crazy. But if you read the letters, you discover it's not crazy. it has a meaning.
Sometimes people want advice. Sometimes they just want to be heard.
We can see in these letters, it's a real unique thing. They don't know who will read the letter, who will answer.
People who reply to the letters are called Juliet's secretaries. A handful of secretaries volunteer their time every day. Donna Curran volunteered during a visit to Verona in 2018.
As I arrived, I thought, oh, these are going to be like 14-year-old kids. They weren't. All ages were writing. It's not like writing letters to Santa.
Curran said she sat at a wooden table in the Juliet Club's office for a couple of hours.
The letters themselves are what blew me away. They were from all over. From Russia, Poland, California, Louisiana, Michigan, New Jersey. All of them decorated stationery. I mean, these were not just whipped out on notebook. One was 12 pages long.
Curran said reading and replying to those letters was a privilege.
It felt really personally revealing about a heartbreak or a dilemma. The responses I put back was trying to acknowledge what they said so that they knew somebody real read it.
And there are no standard replies, says club manager Giovanna Tamasia.
Each letter is answered in a personal way. When people come to reply, it's very heartfelt. So they feel like being in a mission of love or in the name of Juliet.
Those personal touches and attention to detail don't go unnoticed. Lena Siboney is a junior at the University of California. She wrote a letter to Juliet when she was in Verona for vacation.
I 100% didn't think I was going to get anything back. You kind of think of it as like throwing a penny into a fountain. Like, it's just a nice idea.
A couple of months went by. Then a letter from Juliet arrived in Siboney's mailbox.
I'm like, wait, what?
She said the response she received was meaningful and personal.
In a silly way, it really felt like a moment of humanity, of somebody really taking the time to be careful and to be kind and sweet to somebody young and hopeful.
A local bank pays for the office space. The city of Verona pays for the stamps. And Shakespeare's love story of Romeo and Juliet lives on.
It kind of restored my faith in mankind.
They're focusing on something so fundamentally basic and human, and the desire for love, the desire for comfort and connection.
The letters are really like a treasure. So many love stories in all languages from every corner of the world. There isn't anything else that can be compared.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you're feeling the love and want to send a letter, the Juliet Club's mailing address is on our Twitter account. We are at PRI The World. The British government has a report on alleged Russian interference in UK politics, but it's not made it public yet. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is waiting until after Election Day next month to release it. Hillary Clinton sat down with our BBC colleagues today as part of her book tour and offered this opinion.
I'm dumbfounded that this government won't release the report about Russian influence, because every person who votes in this country deserves to see that report before your election happens.
Another person who's dumbfounded, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, an elder statesman of the UK's Conservative Party. He spoke with us on a scratchy landline from his home.
I very much agree with the view that number 10 Downing Street should be releasing this report. I see no good reason why they should not. And we have not heard any convincing reason why the report cannot be published.
So just remind us briefly what the report had been looking at and what you think could be in this report.
I can't give you any detailed view of the content, but it was looking at the question of whether Russia has been involved in political interference in the United Kingdom. We all know that in the United States, the question of Russian involvement was absolutely central during your last presidential elections. What puzzles me about the problem we're having in the United Kingdom is there no similar circumstances. The present British Prime Minister, Mr. Johnson, and his Conservative colleagues are no friends of the Kremlin. And therefore, there is no reason why they themselves should have some party political reason why this report should not be published if it makes any reference to Russian behavior in the United Kingdom.
If the government says there's nothing to worry about in this report, why not just trust the government then?
That's exactly what puzzles me. I can only speculate that some of the staffers close to the Prime Minister, for reasons relating to some phrase or sentence somewhere in the report, decided it would be helpful for it not to be there. I think if they'd realized that this would become an important issue and that people like myself would be interviewed by people in the United States on this subject, they might have thought twice before doing it.
Sir Malcolm Rifkin, former Foreign Secretary of the UK, supporting the release of a government report into Russian interference in British politics. In India, coal is king. It accounts for more than half of India's electricity. Coal is cheap, but also contributes to air pollution and climate change. And now Indian coal is facing a backlash. Renewable energy supporters are turning India into a global leader for wind and solar projects. But India's coal industry is fighting back, transforming working coal mines into tourist attractions. Reporter Sindhya Banu lays out India's energy battlefields.
India is the second most populated country in the world. More than a billion people live there, and almost a fourth of those people live below the poverty line. So this is a country that really needs power, and it needs it cheaply. And India has the fifth largest coal reserves in the world, and so coal has been the way to go for a long time there.
So still a lot of support for coal, it sounds like, in India. How much of those attitudes are changing now, and why are they changing?
Well, last year in the state of Gujarat, farmers, a mob of farmers were protesting the development of a coal-based power plant.
Air pollution jahan kam karne ki baat ki jati hai to hamesha baat ki jati hai coal power plant ko
leke. In September there were marches in several major cities.
There's no earth B. If we destroyed it, there's no other planet we can survive to.
Jalvayu parivartan ke mudde par climate change jo ki is waqt
thousands of Indians came out calling for a reduction in fossil fuel use.
Climate change is not allowed.
Don't let our people die!
There's a growing awareness about environmental issues in general and also about the health effects of coal-based power plants, particularly among the upper middle class and the upper class. We're seeing this shift.
So one of the state-controlled coal companies has come up with this unique way to try and address this public relations problem with coal. You've been reporting on these efforts. What are they doing exactly?
Right. So this company is called Western Coal Limited. It's in the state of Maharashtra. And what they've done is they've developed this day-long eco-mine tour. It's the first of its kind in India. So I went on this tour. And you go down what's like a ski lift, but it's going down instead of up. And it takes you into the mine about 6,000 feet. There's a ventilator. It's blowing air. It's very loud. Sort of get off after the ride, and then you walk. After that, you're on foot deeper into the mine. There's still lights, but it starts to get dark. The air starts to get still. So our guide was the general manager of the mine, Divakar Gokhale.
Machine has started, na? So you can see the operation from here also.
We saw a front loader loading the coal and then dumping it onto a conveyor belt.
Because this is the transfer point of coal.
And miners also were using shovels to manually get some of that coal onto the belt.
What is the goal of offering these tours? Is it a total PR move?
Well, this whole experience was conceived by the chairman of the company, Ashish Mishra.
When we produce coal, there is a common thinking that we pollute environment. So we had an idea in the mind that why don't we make this thing transparent and make it open for public.
For Mishra, this is all about educating the Indian public. He wants people to know how hard these coal miners work. And he told me he wants people to know that whenever they see a light bulb on in India, that coal is behind it.
Slowly, I feel that coal will be taken over by renewable energy. But for next 10 years at least, I don't see any change in the growth of use of coal in our country.
So are these tours having the intended effect? Are they changing people's minds about coal?
Well, it's hard to know exactly, but people are going on the tour. The company told me that over 200,000 people have visited since they first started this 2 years ago. The visitors I talked to said that they knew nothing about the mining process until they went on the tour. So like Mishra wanted, it's an educational experience. So those are things I think that leave a good impression as you leave the tour.
So, of course, Cynthia, the big environmental news from India has been about the horrible choking smog in Delhi, which is not primarily from coal-fired power plants. But people know their air is polluted from many sources. Has there been pushback against this coal charm offensive from, like, green activists?
Yeah, definitely. I spoke to one environmentalist who said that this tour is just a publicity stunt. I also spoke to a doctor who said that in the last decade, he's seen a major spike in asthma among the villagers who live near the mines, and he blames the coal-based power plants. But I think the takeaway here is that there's this inherent ongoing tension. Renewables are coming. The prime minister is pushing for it, but it's going to take time. And in the meantime, we're seeing this sort of uprising from urban and rural Indians that are concerned about air quality and health and safety. So in light of that, I think the coal industry is just trying to put its best foot forward.
Reporter Cynthia Banu, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco. Great talking to you.
And that does it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.